Hard to tell. I think it's quite mixed. Like the amount of lightning isn't actually linked to the severity of the thunderstorm. So when we say severity, we mean it has things like really intense rainfall or really strong winds associated with it. So the lightning intensity actually isn't related to the storm intensity for those attributes, if that makes sense.
G'day everyone and welcome to episode 52 of the Flight Training Australia podcast. Podcast all about flight training and flying in Australia and beyond. I'm your host Trent Robinson. Thank you again for joining me. If it's your first time listening to the podcast, welcome and hope you get something out of it. There's heaps of episodes. I try and make sure that they're relevant to everybody and there's a bit for beginners, medium level, advanced, professional, recreational and everything in between. Heaps of interviews, heaps of topics, and anything you might want covered, feel free to drop me an email, info@trentrobinsonaviation.com.au. All my links are in the episode description below in whatever player you are listening to. Feel free to keep those reviews coming as well. Again, heaps this week. Thank you, guys. The messages and emails have been just brilliant. Some of you first-time listeners and others have been listening for some time. So truly, thanks for all those reviews. Keep them coming. And just keep telling me what you're up to, what you're flying, where you are. I really love to hear all your stories and where you're up to as you go through your training and kick some goals. All right, so in episode 32, I was joined by special guest Harrison Burns-Fabb. Harrison's from the Aviation Department in the Bureau of Meteorology, and he was kind enough to talk all about the dry season weather and phenomena, and I promised when the wet season came along that he'd come back, and I paid him enough for a show up. He's here today. Harrison, thanks for joining us, mate.
Hi, Trent, and yeah, thanks for having me again. It was a really good session last time, and yeah, good to be back talking about the wet season and all the exciting weather that comes with it.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. Look, I love it, and you obviously love it even more doing it as a job, and especially up here in Darwin. I think if you haven't been up here and experienced what it's like, it's quite phenomenal. And already such a kickoff to the wet season, hardly a build-up at all what it felt like. It was very quick and seemed to be just getting stuck into the thunderstorms and rain very promptly.
Yeah, it's certainly getting to that time of the year. Going into the later half of October and November is where things really start to ramp up. We get a lot more added moisture in the atmosphere that really gives the thunderstorms a lot more of an opportunity to really get going and stay going, I guess. Earlier in the wet season build-up period, September, early October, you've got a lot of dry air in the atmosphere, which the thunderstorms struggle when there's a lot of that around. You only get one or two pop up and decay really quickly. So yeah, things heating up.
Definitely. All right. Well, the idea is obviously we get a lot of new pilots coming up to Darwin and across even the tropics right through. So really from Broome right across to sort of Cairns, Townsville and even a bit further south down to Brizzy, as you say. So what I wanted to try and go through is just some of the basics, which, pretty much everybody learns, but just some of the more specifics about why Darwin's such a hot spot, I guess we could call it. Some of the most highest lightning counts in Australia, and the build up and all the different things that mean it, the build up, the wet season, the monsoon. So do you want to kick that off and maybe why this year is potentially going to be more active than normal as well?
Yeah, for sure. So I guess to work out why Darwin and the top end is so such a hotspot for the thunderstorms, and also right across tropical Australia, we need to, I guess, take a step back and have a look at what we need for thunderstorms to form. So basically what we look at is three different ingredients. So what we need is an unstable atmosphere, basically meaning that the temperature falls rapidly with height. So that basically means that you've got air at the surface, and when that heats up, it can rise really quickly, which is what we call an unstable atmosphere. We also need the second thing being a lifting mechanism. So that's kind of like a trigger, something to get the thunderstorms going. So if you have the other ingredients, you still need a trigger to really, you know, just light the match, so to speak. And the third thing is, as you probably are all aware, a lot of sufficient moisture around. So you need that humidity in the low levels of the atmosphere. And that's not just at the surface. We're looking through the lower kind of depth of the atmosphere for that moisture to be there. So then when you actually get that air rising up because of the instability and the lifting mechanism, that can continue to rise up and basically, you know, condense into those visible water droplets that you see as cloud. And then as that cloud grows, it has more moisture feeding into it. And so why these are important is for the top end and a lot of the tropics, you often have throughout the wet season, two of these things. So you've got a lot of moisture, as you know, it's pretty humid and sticky and also quite an unstable atmosphere. The third thing that comes and goes a bit more than the other two ingredients is the lifting mechanism. So I'm sure we'll talk about a few specific storms a bit later, but lifting mechanisms can be in the form of like sea breezes coming in, converging with other winds, and that forces the air upwards. It can be things like troughs moving through, monsoonal troughs, tropical lows, tropical cyclones, all of those kind of things, topography, anything that prompts the air to start moving upwards. And that's when we start, you know, getting those cumulus fields popping up, then developing into the cumulonimbus thunderstorm clouds.
Yeah, okay. So the instability, is that just temperature alone? Because obviously, you know, I've been down south and it seems quite cold and still get thunderstorms. Is that just meaning it's not as intense or?
Yeah, so it's basically it's relative. So it may be cooler at the surface, but it's also cooler above. So the whole kind of thing is shifted a bit. So long as it's warmer at the surface than above, it will enable that air to rise, as you know, hot air is less dense, so it's got that buoyancy, so it can rise up. So yeah, you're right in that in the south, the surface temperatures are cooler, but the upper air temperatures are also cooler. So relative, it can still get things going. And we also have more complicated thunderstorm formation mechanisms as well, whereas you know, these ones we're talking about are at the surface. You can have thunderstorms kind of being generated above the surface. So you'll actually have the air rising from a point above the surface, even higher up, which, is quite complicated and also quite difficult to forecast.
Yeah, well, that weather predicting is obviously a real art form to just know when thunderstorms are going to pop up. I guess we've got a bit of a joke up here that, you know, even though the forecast might be blank, you can pretty much guarantee by 11, 12 o'clock there's going to be some inters and tempos and thunderstorms listed somewhere. So, yeah, I don't envy you trying to do all that.
So, yeah, when we're looking to forecast thunderstorms across the top end and across the tropics, we're looking for those areas where there is the moisture and instability present. And then I guess from there we drill down into what the smaller scale effects are. So where the trigger points might be, where the sea breeze convergence will start to trigger thunderstorms. And yeah, what time that will be. So the timing of the thunderstorms is often quite consistent in the tropics because the atmosphere can be quite consistent too. So you've got similar amounts of moisture and instability there, and also similar daytime temperatures, which provides that lower level heating and therefore instability. So, yeah, like you said, you quite often get those thunderstorms being generated in the afternoon because that's when that surface heating is enough to actually create that instability and get that air to rise.
All right. So then what's happening with the ones sometimes will wake up at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning or even a bit later, and is that just the land releasing the heat overnight?
Yes. So what happens overnight is when we have the right conditions for more so severe thunderstorms, we can actually, those thunderstorms will often be generated during the day. So in the afternoon, inland somewhere, if we're talking about the top end of Darwin, maybe inland near Jabiru or something, And then what they do is they can move, they basically continue to throughout the night or evening. And as they move into Darwin, they can just basically continue because they have a few extra characteristics that the average, you know, afternoon thunderstorm doesn't have. So they can kind of keep generating their own energy and basically, yeah, continue to move right through into Darwin. So when you've got lifting mechanisms that are a bit stronger than the average, you know, sea breeze convergence or something, if you've got a strong surge in the lower level winds or a trough or something, that can actually provide the lifting to continue right throughout the night. So you don't just see those, yeah, afternoon thunderstorms decaying by the evening, nothing at night kind of thing. And like, especially deep in the wet season when you get a lot of monsoonal activity, that's typically more so overnight because it's actually coming off the ocean, which is, yeah, more favorable overnight than during the day, which is, yeah, basically switched from the land.
Yeah, righto. So what is it that makes Darwin such a hot spot? Like, I think the average, there's a slide there on the Bureau of Met page with the average thunder days, and Darwin's, I think, around 80 there. It's obviously not coastal alone because it's surrounded by other coastal areas that aren't as affected as much. So what is it that makes it so special there?
Yeah, so I guess there's a few things. So the first being that a lot of the winds we get are easterly or southeasterly winds. So then looking at the eastern part of the top end, they get a lot of air coming off the ocean, which is a bit cooler than air coming off land. So then that prevents thunderstorms forming. So the western part of the top end then, I guess, gets more of an opportunity to heat up because the air mass is coming from inland, you know, Catherine, Jabiru, that kind of area, and over the west coast. And also, yeah, we get those sea breezes coming in off the west coast as well and basically impacting those southeasterly winds. And that really creates a really good trigger point for thunderstorms, yeah, along that west coast or inland of the west coast, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a few different coasts.
Yeah.
Okay. So I was standing there the other day and like I can literally just, it was almost like watching a time lapse. You can just see the edges of the cloud billowing and building, and it was just a cloud before, and then it's suddenly become something a lot more ominous. So again, that's just these exceptional conditions, I'm guessing. But is that again different to up here that these storms do build quite quickly, which again is something pilots need to be mindful of, that what might look benign, by the time you actually get closer to it or even under it, it could be something a bit more significant and dangerous.
Yeah, absolutely. The level of moisture and instability present over the top end or tropics as well is such that when you actually do get that trigger, it can just go boom and happen really quickly. Whereas if there's kind of marginal amounts of moisture and instability, things might happen a little slower. So yeah, as you said, like over the top end in particular, you've got those early stages of, you know, cumulus growth where you see lots of cumulus across the area, and then you'll see those, yeah, billowing, towering cumulus start to develop. And then you get into the, I guess, more mature stage of the thunderstorm where you've got the really strong updrafts and it's developing into a, you know, cumulonimbus. Therefore, it's, you know, producing thunder and lightning. And yeah, basically, like, you can have the stage from, you know, just being a cumulus cloud right through to being a thunderstorm all happen in, you know, 15 to 30 minutes or so. So yeah, really primed to, I guess, get going pretty quickly. So yeah, when you start to see those cumulus clouds actually grow, you're getting these updraft right throughout that cloud. And then when it actually gets a bit higher, so towering cumulus as well as cumulonimbus, you're getting updrafts as well as downdraft. So that's what we call the mature stage of the thunderstorm. And that's where, yeah, a lot of the hazards can be generated. You know, you get really strong wind shear, turbulence, all that kind of thing in the thunderstorm. And as you said, that can happen pretty quickly.
Yeah. So I know when we study in our theory books and things, it says that typical life cycle is about 30 minutes. Though if you look up in the sky, it would appear that it's just there for ages. So is that a cell growing, dying with another one basically growing right behind it, or do they have a different lifespan and as far as severity and, you know, us then needing to avoid it or being prepared to keep our distance better?
Yeah, so that that life cycle I just went through is a typical life cycle for what we call a pulse thunderstorm, which, as you said, you know, lasts 30 minutes, 45 minutes, that kind of thing. We can get other types of thunderstorms which are more severe, which they actually, so in a pulse thunderstorm, what happens is you get the updraft in the developing phase, but then when it's developed enough, you'll get downdraft as well. So these updrafts and downdrafts start working against each other, and it basically chokes its own thunderstorm updraft. So then it kind of decays. But in other thunderstorms that we often classify as, you know, severe thunderstorms, such as like supercell thunderstorms and that, if that updraft and downdraft are actually separated, the thunderstorm can just keep going. So it's basically generating that that continuous updraft and downdraft concurrently. And that's often when you've got a supercell thunderstorm and it's moving quite quickly, because then you can easily separate those updrafts and downdrafts.
Yeah, okay. And is that increase updraft, downdraft, what's causing the like the build-up thunderstorms and the sort of really regular intense lightning?
Okay, so so when we're talking about lightning intensity, that's often not linked to the actual intensity of the thunderstorm when we talk about severe phenomena associated with the thunderstorm, such as really strong winds or really heavy rainfall or large hail and that kind of thing. So the lightning intensity is basically related to the difference in the charge in the cloud, which is what generates the lightning. And that static can basically be linked to those updrafts and downdrafts.
Yeah, okay.
And I'm not sure if that answered your question.
Yeah, no, I think that makes sense. So when you do see all this lightning, like obviously when it's close, you hear the thunder. And the timing will sort of show where it is. But when these really rapid lightning cells seem to be going off, sometimes you hear a bit of a distant rumble, but they're just, other times you don't really seem to hear any thunder associated with it. Is it just because it's too far away, but the light's obviously traveling further? So I'm not talking about the lightning bolts, but just the internal cloud lighting. Yeah.
Yeah. So quite often you might be able to see the lightning on the horizon. But maybe not hear the thunder as you said, a really distant rumble. That's basically because lightning and thunder travel to you in different ways. So light travels, you know, at the speed of light, it will get to you through most mediums, unless there's an obstacle in between. But sound travels a lot slower. I think it's about 340 meters per second in kind of normal atmospheric conditions. So those sound waves can dissipate a lot quicker than the visible light that you see from the lightning. So it's harder for the sound to actually reach you, and it will be affected much more by, you know, atmospheric phenomena, other sounds and that kind of thing.
All right, well, we have probably I guess three main areas around Darwin where we get thunderstorms coming from. So one's down towards Port Keats direction, coming from the southwest and heading up, and we sort of, I think that one's sometimes called the Julep Monster. There's a IFR waypoint called Julep down there. Then we've got, sort of the Owenpilly Jabiru coming through Adelaide River, usually straight on to Darwin Airport. And then we've got our old mate over at the Bathurst Melville Islands, the Tiwi Islands there, called Hector. So what makes those sort of three locations, what it almost seems like clockwork and just so predictable, what makes them so ideal?
A lot of those storms are actually formed from what we call sea breeze convergence. So I'll talk about Hector first because that's it's very well studied because it's such a perfect example of sea breeze convergence causing thunderstorms. So because you've got these islands, you get sea breezes forming all around the coast. And then in the afternoon at, you know, pretty similar times of the day, those sea breezes come in and all converge at one point. And then that convergence creates a lifting mechanism and then that triggers the thunderstorms that we call Hector. And because the sea surface temperature around the Tiwi Islands and the land temperature remain pretty consistent throughout the wet season, you get a consistent sea breeze forming, and that, you know, happens at a consistent time. Therefore, the thunderstorms can consistently form at those times. So, it's a very well-studied thunderstorm because of its consistency. I feel like I've said that word many times right now, but it's
regularity.
Regularity, exactly. It's so regular that, it's just this kind of textbook case of sea breeze convergence forming. And I guess that's where it got its name in the Second World War, apparently, because pilots named it so they could use it as a bit of a, you know.
It's like a nav aid, yeah.
Exactly. Then looking at the other locations, so down near Port Keats, again, you're getting a bit of a, like, not really a peninsula, but if you kind of zoom out on the map, you can see it kind of a bit of a curved area, and that can generate a bit of convergence as well from sea breezes. Like, you don't need the sea breeze coming at all angles for thunderstorms to form. It can be just one perfect line, or in, you know, down near Port Keats, it's slightly angled, so it will converge into one spot eventually. Looking at over near Jabiru and Oumpali, you've got coastlines that are also slightly angled. So you've got the north coast and then the coast, I guess, slightly to the west of that is also slightly angled. So when you get the sea breezes, they come in and the converge.
Coburg Peninsula there, yeah.
Exactly, yeah. So inland of the Coburg Peninsula there. And you can also get a bit of a phenomenon called, like, because that area is quite rocky, you get a lot of extra surface heating. So during the day, it can get warmer than the surrounding area. So that actually gives, you know, more fuel to the thunderstorm developing.
Yeah, okay. No, that makes sense. I mean, yeah, they're definitely, like I said, it might not say anything on the weather, but you can pretty much guarantee there'll be something there. And some of them just look huge and are coming in quite rapidly. And then this thing happens where it gets close to the airport and then it just either splits or it just goes poof. And everyone thinks there's a dome over their house or a dome over Darwin or the airport. And sometimes it comes through, like the other night, we all got smashed and everyone thought it was going to, wither away. But other times it does wither away. So what's that all about?
Yeah, we call it the Berrima traffic lights. I think that's the main barrier to the storms getting through. They can't get through there. But basically what happens is, I feel like I've mentioned sea breeze about a million times, but again, it's the sea breeze coming in. Yeah, exactly. It's it's quite a fine scale effect. So forecasting it can be quite difficult. But what happens is you get the storms forming inland and they start moving towards Darwin, but you've also got a sea breeze coming from, you know, from Darwin, from the coastline there, towards the thunderstorm. And if that sea breeze moves inland, further inland of Darwin than where the storm's already reached, the sea breeze will cool the area that it's moved over, and that basically prevents that surface heating from continuing the thunderstorm life cycle. So it basically comes up against the sea breeze and collapses. And that's why it's quite common for it to hit those, that area, the Berrima traffic lights, and kind of collapse.
Yeah, so I guess that's a bit confusing because, as you said, you keep saying the sea breeze is a big component of making all this happen, but it's also a big reason for it not. So it's obviously that air or the quality of the air that is making all the difference. And it's funny that you've said that, you know, sometimes the air's too dry, but, you know, I'm outside and I can tell you it's not dry.
Yeah, so we're looking at basically, you know, from the surface right up to, you know, 10,000 feet or so. So, yeah, you might feel pretty humid at the surface, but like, you know,
yeah,
a few hundred feet above, it might be really dry. So, yeah, there's a lot of kind of detail to look in above the surface there to see if those storms can actually get going. And, yeah, the sea breeze is, it's kind of like if you think of it as a big front moving through, on that front, it's providing a trigger. So if the sea breeze moves over Darwin and inland, you get storms forming inland. But behind it, it's actually kind of acting to suppress the area a bit. So, yeah, it's kind of very small, fine scale detail as to whether the sea breeze is strong enough to really get in and form storms inland, or if it's not very strong, maybe you get storms closer to Darwin.
Yeah, okay. All right. As far as this year goes, and we'll have a look at cyclones shortly, but we've got a La Nina event. So just to explain what that actually means, and then there's these other things I keep hearing about with negative Indian Ocean dipoles and the Madden-Julian effect, MJO, Madden-Julian oscillations and things. What's all that feeding into, and how those things, because that's obviously a long way away. Well, it's obvious to me because I know where it is, but for everyone not knowing, it's not right around Australia. It's obviously equatorial patterns and all this stuff affecting what's going on here, and stuff way down south as well.
So when we talk about La Nina, we're looking at what we call the El Nino Southern Oscillation Index. And there's, you know, a few components to that being La Nina or El Nino. And between these two phases, you can have a neutral phase as well. So at the moment, we're in La Nina phase. And basically what that means is we're looking at the area between the basically Papua New Guinea and South America in that equatorial Pacific region. And we're looking at the trade winds, whether they're, you know, stronger or weaker than normal, because that will have an effect on the ocean and then either, you know, draw warmer ocean currents to one part of the Pacific or another. And that has a huge impact on the weather. So for La Nina, we get stronger trade winds, meaning that cooler, deeper water comes up from below to the surface, meaning that the, I guess, central and eastern part of the Pacific Ocean, so closer to the Americas, cools. And then we actually then get a warming effect on the other side, so our side of the Pacific Ocean. And those trade winds also kind of pile up those warm surface waters as well. So warm surface waters, if you think of it as, you know, you're boiling a pot on the stove, if the water's hot, it'll start evaporating a lot more. So same thing happens if we've got warmer waters around to the north of Australia, we'll get a lot more evaporation, a lot more moisture in the atmosphere. And that means that often we see greater rainfall during La Nina events. So yeah, over most of the eastern Australia, we see above average rainfall, and that's the, you know, the forecast for this summer as well. It has a bit of a lesser effect of over the northern region, so the Northern Territory and the tropical region, but it's still, we're looking at a little bit higher than average rainfall. And with that, we also see often a greater than average chance of tropical cyclones and tropical lows developing. So for example, for the northern region, which is, you know, most of the top end and the Gulf and a little further west as well, we're looking at basically a 60% chance of above average tropical cyclones this summer. So that means on average, we get around 3 tropical cyclones around that area. And then looking at the west and the east and parts of tropical Australia, we're looking at around 70% or above chance of above average tropical cyclones and tropical lows.
Yeah, right. So that's why they're saying there's increased chance this year, not because we just haven't had one for a few years, but the conditions are really looking quite favourable.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, exactly. It's kind of like, you know, the average is you know, three, but because we've got these extra conditions that are providing more moisture to the atmosphere and that kind of thing, yeah, there's a 60% chance, so more likely that it's going to be above average this season.
Yeah, right. All right, well, we've just done our cyclone chuck your rubbish out on the verge clean up. I've still got a bit of stuff to do downstairs, but I'll make sure we're ready.
Absolutely.
Got my little cyclone kit. Good to go.
Excellent. Right. Yeah, good to hear.
All right, and then what about this MJO thing, the Madden-Julian Oscillation? How does that all fit into this?
Yeah, so the Madden-Julian Oscillation is a global scale feature similar to, you know, El Niño, La Niña, basically meaning that it affects more of the globe than just Australia. So there's basically this wave of tropical weather moves around the equatorial area of the globe. What we kind of characterize it as is an eastward moving pulse of cloud and rainfall. So like this disturbance moving around near the equator. It typically recurs every 30 to 60 days. So we look at the equatorial area for enhanced activity. It might be, you know, over the African region, right? Might be over the American region. We look for where this extra pulse of, you know, cloud and rainfall is. And that's basically where the MJO is at that point. The thing also to note is that the MJO varies in strength. So sometimes it might pass us by with, you know, it's really weak, so it has very little effect on the weather around our area. Sometimes you get the MJO passing over us and it's really strong and it can actually help to really trigger the monsoon trough developing. And then, yeah, once you get the monsoon trough developing, you've got a heightened chance of, you know, tropical lows, tropical thunderstorms, and also everything that comes with the monsoon, lots of rainfall and that kind of thing.
Yeah, right. Okay, so what is the monsoon and when does it sort of go from the build up to the wet season and then wet season to monsoon, and what sort of conditions can pilots expect during those periods?
So what we refer to as the monsoon is basically where the weather is concentrated around a trough, and that trough moves throughout the year, or that concentration of weather moves throughout the year. So it largely depends on where the maximum heating is on the earth. So obviously in our winter and the northern hemisphere summer, the monsoon trough is in the north of to the north of the equator. So in our wet season, the monsoon trough moves south because you get that added surface heating from the sun, and that provides an area of uplift, basically, because you've got that heating. The ocean sea surface temperatures increase, you get a lot more cloud and all that forming. So when we get the monsoon trough moving down over Australia, to the north of the monsoon trough, you've got these warm, moist, northwesterly winds, and they come basically all the way from, you know, right over Indonesia, right over the maritime continent. And because there's a lot of ocean in that area that's really warm, it brings a lot more moisture to the top end of Australia, and basically, yeah, culminates in this monsoon trough. So if the monsoon trough's sitting over or south of Darwin or south of the top end, that's when you're getting all this. Yeah, the weather basically comes from the northwest or westerly. So you're getting a lot of rainfall, particularly overnight. And, the conditions you can expect sometimes are basically, rainfall with pretty bad visibility and low cloud and things like that for extended periods. We're talking, you know, hours to days even. And sometimes you get embedded thunderstorms within the monsoon trough as well.
So that's definitely periods of lower cloud, and that's when we get our days of rain, weeks even. There's usually around the January, February, March. It's just be 2 to 3 weeks that almost, from flight training point of view, are almost a write off.
Yes, exactly.
It's just not going to sort of let up.
Yeah, the typical monsoon onsets late December. So yeah, like you said, early January, February is really the peak of monsoon activity around Darwin, when you get the warmer temperatures and then yeah, all that moist air moving over the area.
Yeah, okay. So what about icing? We don't seem to get as much hail out of thunderstorms just because it's too warm, even though it's coming from high altitude and still got plenty of time to sort of super cool and form.
Yeah, short answer, yes. Basically, the thunderstorms will have, you know, ice in them. They'll have hail in them, but that hail, when it falls to the surface in the tropics, it's just too warm in the lower levels of the atmosphere, so it melts into rainfall. If you've got, in the south of Australia, if the temperatures are cool enough to not melt that hail, you'll get the hail actually reaching the surface. But yeah, because we've got those really strong updrafts of moisture in a thunderstorm in the tropics, they come from the surface. Lots of moisture goes up really quickly above the freezing level. And then that's where you get these basically what we call super cooled liquid water droplets, which is liquid water existing as a liquid droplet above the freezing level below freezing temperature. So then obviously that's a major hazard for icing, because if that droplet touches something that is also below zero, it will basically freeze upon impact. And thunderstorms, yeah, are really a key area for severe icing because of that, you know, really strong updraft constantly feeding that moisture into that zone of, basically we're looking at kind of 0 degrees to minus 15 degrees above that. You know, when you get even cooler than minus 15, it starts to just all freeze. So, you know, the ice crystals would just be, I guess, bouncing off the aircraft.
Let's have a look at microbursts. So thunderstorms dissipate, but not always a microburst. And like I said, the Saturday, I think this is what Darwin experienced. So he probably just got this, the moisture coming in, just fed it just as it approached, and then almost as quickly then dumped its guts basically. And yeah, this massive downdrafts and huge gusts. It was like some 76 knots. It was blowing airliners off chocks, as well as a few other aircraft that weren't secured as well. So again, what creates that microburst activity? And then we can just obviously have a bit of a chat about how to spot them and the hazards that that creates for pilots as well.
So yeah, a few things lead to those microbursts in the tropics. Basically, we get wet and dry microbursts, mostly wet microbursts in the tropics because there's a lot of moisture in the atmosphere. Going back to what we talked about, instability, when you get a really unstable atmosphere, you also get really strong updrafts developing, because, you know, you think of it as kind of a vacuum that the air can just shoot up really fast. And if you've got really strong updrafts, what happens is all this precipitation sitting in the thunderstorm waiting to fall can't fall because it's being held there because of these updrafts. And so that just keeps being held there and basically reaches critical mass and just drops at the same, well, you know, pretty close to being the same time. And then that's where you get these microbursts happening, because you've got this huge amount of mass of precipitation just dropping all at once, creating these gusts. Because yeah, think about all the water contained in that, it's got to push the air out as it drops, and that's basically where you get those really gusty conditions coming out of it. And so yeah, a few things to look for. You can actually sometimes see like these really well-defined blobs, I guess you could call them, of precipitation falling, and then when it hits the ground, it often spreads out and starts kind of forming these rotors as well. So if you're seeing any of those signs, that's a, you know, telltale sign of there being pretty strong winds there, and also, you know, quite turbulent conditions with the wind shear being, you know, the winds going one way or another in those rotors that form.
Yeah, well, we definitely know there's been some famous accidents as a result of that. And then, yeah, increased aerodrome wind measuring, because obviously the wind can be one end of the airport completely different to the other, depending on where it's approaching from.
Yeah, absolutely. Because there's such a small scale effect, they're, you know, almost impossible to predict exactly where and when they'll be. They, you know, the thunderstorm drops its guts and releases all this energy, and then it might just decay straight after that, kind of thing. So you might be, yeah, really close to that thunderstorm and experience the full effect, or a few kilometers down the road and see or feel nothing.
Is the wet versus dry sort of microburst, is the wet one a bit more hazardous because it's actually got that moisture which is aiding the acceleration of the falling air, or not really? Does it make a difference?
Yeah, they're kind of different, slightly different formation mechanisms. So dry microbursts actually form when you get a lot of dry slots underneath the thunderstorm, and then the precipitation falls into these dry slots and evaporates, and then basically changes the density of that air as it evaporates. And then that actually can cause that air to then basically, you know, become more dense and therefore accelerate the air. So, yep.
All right. And Virga is often, and it's another sign, isn't it? Because you sort of look at that, go, oh, it's just a bit of drizzle, but it's not hitting the ground. It's okay, I can fly under that. But it's actually quite hazardous, isn't it? And you could be in that clearer section and be, yeah, really getting thumped around.
Yeah, for sure. If there's, you know, towering cumulus or cumulonimbus around and it's not precipitating much, or it's just, you know, creating a bit of Virga, those clouds in themselves still have, you know, all the hazards associated with thunderstorms, such as, you know, really strong wind shear and turbulence within them, all the really bad icing, you know, severe icing within them, and that kind of thing.
Yeah, all right. So from my point of view of, if I'm looking at a thunderstorm and then I'm trying to work out, you know, how much to avoid it by, depending on the manual and the company you work for, we can say 10 to 20 miles. But, you know, it can look like it's clear air, but it's similar to the microburst thing and Virga, that even though it's looking like clear air, you might see two shafts of water coming down and think, all right, I can go in the middle because there's no storm there. But that's linking into the air hitting the ground, pushing in front of it, outflow boundaries, I think is that what it's called? And that can obviously be existing in the middle between these two cells as well, and it's just not a good idea.
Yeah, spot on. So like because that you've got all these updrafts, downdrafts, basically lots of air moving around in a turbulent way inside the thunderstorm, there's no like set boundary where it's just like perfectly calm. So outside of a thunderstorm, there will be all of these kind of turbulent air movements around it. So yeah, it obviously dissipates the further you go from the thunderstorm, but it's definitely not limited to, you know, just the cloud mass or just in precipitation. As you said, you can get microbursts hitting the ground. The air mass can travel quite a way. You also get gust fronts, which basically can continue for, you know, hundreds of kilometers, which, can actually trigger more thunderstorms as they go. So definitely something to keep in mind is, just because you can't see, you know, the cloud or the precipitation or something, conditions around the thunderstorm can be, yeah, quite hazardous in terms of turbulence and wind shear and that kind of thing.
So I was coming into Darwin the other day, and with the weather being about 15, 20 miles off, there's definitely, you could see a little bit. It wasn't a big microburst, but definitely the wind affecting us. By the time we completed the approach, the wind had gone from a 20-odd knot headwind to right abeam us, and it was just starting to swing around with the thunderstorm downdrafts then dominating the sea breeze, and they actually resulted in a change of runway temporarily.
So, yeah, like talking about those updrafts and downdrafts, microbursts in a thunderstorm, the winds you get from a thunderstorm can be, you know, in all directions, so to speak. You often get winds coming out of a thunderstorm. So, you know, one side of the storm, they'll be blowing in one direction, and then on the other side of the storm, they might be blowing in another. And it's stronger than neutral synoptic winds. So that ego dominate any other prevailing wish.
So really the gist thing is just give it a wide berth, go around or stay on the ground, but just, yeah, don't mess with it. It's just not worth it.
Yeah, sounds like sensible advice to me.
Brilliant, Harrison. Thank you so much, mate. Look, I think it's been some fantastic information there. And along with this podcast, there'll be a video with a lot of diagrams, video and things sort of supporting what we've been talking about. And as always, mate, the Bureau of Met website has some great information. And, of course, if anyone's in any concerns whatsoever, give the Bureau of Met a call. The number's on the gaff. And they can talk to the office and get some more intelligent insight than, you know, based on the pilot's experience levels.
Yeah, absolutely. The first thing you mentioned is go to the website. There's a little spot called the Knowledge Center on the aviation section of our website. There's some really good brochures on all kinds of phenomena, thunderstorms being one of them. So, yeah, there's some really nice diagrams that may explain things a bit better than what I have today. So feel free to go on there and have a look. Really good information there. And, yeah, Trent, as you mentioned, we're happy to chat about the weather at any point. So, you know, there's only so much information we can put into a forecast for aviation, given there's, you know, really strict requirements we have to follow. But, yeah, more than happy to talk about the weather outside of that forecast or any other conditions that you might be experiencing. If something's not on the forecast that you are experiencing, give us a call as well. We're really keen to hear that information because, yeah, the tropics of Australia is a big place and we only have limited observations in some places. So the more data, the better.
Yeah, definitely. It's something I think we could all work together, especially as we've talked about previously, just the remoteness of Australia and the ocean areas you've got to cover as well, not just the land. With the satellite information and everything else. And again, if you haven't seen that, go to the dry season video online or the podcast episode 32. And we talked all about the satellite information as well, which is probably really being heavily used at the moment with the thunderstorms and cyclone monitoring.
Absolutely, it is. Yeah, we've got really high quality satellite images these days. So, yeah, as we discussed previously, makes that job a lot easier.
Awesome. All right, mate. Thank you again for your time. That was awesome. We'll figure out something else to talk about in another 6 months or so if you're keen. And again, thanks for the Bureau of Met for making your time available today.
Sounds good. Thanks, Trent, for having me, and hopefully everyone got something out of it.
All right, thanks, Harrison. Talk soon, buddy.
Cheers.
All right, guys, hope you enjoyed that. Harrison Birdfabs from the Bureau of Meteorology. So all those links will be in the description below, and keep an eye out on the YouTube channel, Flight Training Australia YouTube channel. There's a few videos there now. There are more coming soon. Just trying to finish off the time, the production. I tell you what, it takes some effort, but it'll be well worth it. So make sure you head over there and subscribe, hit the notification button, and this episode will come out with some animations and visuals and things as well, along with some other stuff coming soon. I know I keep saying it, but I swear it's on its way. It's coming. I'm just going to stop flying. That's all. All right, guys. All the links in the description below, email, social media, jump on there, Instagram, Facebook, LinkedIn, it's all there. Have a fantastic week flying wherever you are. Stay safe, and we'll be back again next Monday. Until then, remember the golden rule. Aviate, navigate, communicate. Cheers, everyone.